This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Good morning, dudes.
Mid dudes.
That's the song. It's a work in progress.
Mid dudes.
That's Fan Club. Hello, my name is Nick Helm.
And my name is Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to Nick
and Matt's
Metcalf's
Fan Club.
I'm just sorry to throw in that Metcalf curveball at you. I just think I'm probably slightly better known than you, and I can get away with just being Nick.
Reckon.
I think people know Nick.
Okay, like Madonna.
Yeah, like Madonna or Prince Philip. I call him Philip. And what a lovely day. Isn't it warm?
It is warm.
Sweaty though, isn't it?
Fucking
hot in the city tonight. Who is it?
Hot in the City Tonight.
Yeah, it's Billy Idol.
Is it?
I think it is. Yes, it is. So we've got a jam-packed episode this week.
Oh, we've got so much. So much content.
So much content. It seems silly to put any content in the first half hour. So we won't. We've done a minute and a half and we've got straight into it. Straight into the show. Did you watch the BAFTAs last week?
I did watch the BAFTAs last week.
Did you watch it after the class?
I did. Did you enjoy
I didn't watch it.
Oh, did you not?
Didn't watch it.
Wrote Joanna Lumley's script. It was something else.
Yes, but that's... But my friend Christine Rose, who is a comedy writer, pointed out that it's not the writer that has forced Joanna Lumley to say the thing. The writer is very low down on the pecking order. It's Joanna Lumley has said, yeah, I'll do that. The director of the show has said, yeah, that's good. Everyone, yes. The writer has given them, I would say, for those opening monologues, a selection of maybe 100 jokes.
And
they've gone that one.
I'll give you an example. Nick.
And I would say that the writer would sometimes be like, no, not that one. Like they'd be mortified.
Yeah.
But they're out of their hands by that point. I didn't see it. What I did do was I opened it up on a YouTube tab and it was, and I never got around to watching it yesterday.
There was a bit where they said, coming up to present an award, we've got one of the stars of the new superhero Netflix series, The Umbrella Academy. I wonder what their special powers are. Keeping the rain off you. And it was just like cutting to audience members who were just kind of like going, oh. Like it's just like you felt wounded. You were going like, oh no.
Fair enough though. I mean, what else are they going to do? I wonder what they're good at. Getting lost in a pub. Yeah. I found an umbrella. I got it from TK Maxx and it was a rainy day and I needed an umbrella and I bought one. I think it was $7.99 and it had a button. I tell you what I was a fan of. Just make it relevant.
It's relevant.
And it had a button and then the action.
The whole umbrella opened?
Yeah, the action of the umbrella opening was absolutely gorgeous. Oh, it was just fucking so fucking satisfying. Mm. The handle was sort of like a matte finished. It wasn't quite rubbery, but it was kind of like it was nice to the touch. Mm-hmm. You could get a good grip on it. It wasn't a retractable umbrella. It was just a full length umbrella, like a walking cane. So when like a parasol,
it's very good for $7.99.
It's TK Maxx, isn't it?
Oh.
That's what I used to call Tom Kerridge, but he's lost a lot of weight. And the other thing was that it had the colours that you'd have of like what's the name of that bank that has the coloured umbrellas?
I know exactly what you mean. What is that? Is that
Wilford and Brimley?
Bradford and Brimley.
Wilford and Brimley.
Wilford and Brimley, yeah. Wilford Brimley, it's the same age as Brad Pitt when he made... All right, mate.
You know Wilford Brimley? He was the same age as Brad Pitt when they were both born. All right, mate, we get it. He's probably a very heavy, probably a very heavy drinker.
I watched the film.
I haven't finished my story, mate.
No, we're packed with content.
Do you know what we've stopped doing? Listening to each other. So I'm just going to turn your mic down while I finish this story.
Bradford and Bingley.
So, but it was like a pastel version of the Bradford and Bingley umbrella, mm-hmm. and it was pissing it down that day. I remember. And hang on a minute.
Sound of it.
It's pissing it down that day. I remember. and me and the kid from Uncle decided to get out of the rain. Go and see Bohemian Rhapsody. I'd spent the whole morning boasting about my new umbrella and showing off, and I even let him have a go on it.
Press the button.
Open.
He must have been excited, didn't he?
Oh, he loved it.
He loved it.
I mean, what else is a 16-year-old boy going to do? So we went to see Bohemian Rhapsody, and I loved that film. I don't think it's a good film by any stretch of the imagination, but it is an enjoyable film. Does it deserve Best Picture Oscar? Yes. And
does it?
And I haven't read any newspapers or any websites in a long time, but I think Bryan Singer deserves a bit of recognition. all the best to him. So fucking hell. In all the excitement of seeing Bohemian Rhapsody and some of my heroes brought to life on the big screen.
The kid from Jurassic Park
brought to life yet again. I left the... Well, end of story. I left the umbrella in the cinema.
Oh.
And I didn't even notice it at the time. Furious I was. And I'm embarrassed to say, I took it out on that kid. What have you been a fan of this week?
Well, I was about to say, I don't know. It seems.
What were you going to say?
It was an aside rather than a point.
When you were interrupting me earlier,
exactly. Because I was interrupting because it was an aside rather than a good point. I was about to say I watched the film Moneyball yesterday.
Oh yeah.
I quite like it, but I think Brad Pitt sometimes in films where he's playing like a normal person, and I've noticed this, I think Brad Pitt pulls a face in films where he's meant to be like a normal, not especially good-looking person. I think he does a thing where he juts out his bottom lip, and he does this thing where it's like in his head he's going, I need to not look
like
incredibly handsome. So I'm going to do a little thing. And it's like, I think you do this in lots of films where you're trying to be a bit more everyman-y. And he sort of juts out his bottom lip and he sort of does this kind of sort of like face like that.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Now you mention it. Yeah.
And I think that's what it is. And I wonder if consciously or unconsciously he's going, well, it's kind of look ridiculous to be this sort of everyman bloke. Because everyone will just be like, it's Brad Pitt. and it feels like, I wonder if that's the thing he does.
I wouldn't totally discredit Brad Pitt's attractiveness down to just his looks. It's probably also down to how successful he is and how much money he's got.
Mm.
So maybe if he pretended not only to be ugly, but also a poor lazy man, then maybe that would help his performance. I find that offensive. Oh, let's give Christian Bale an Oscar. He was fat for one film. Give me an Oscar.
I don't know as well. Like, I think the funny thing
about me an Oscar.
Vice is, when you see it, you go, oh, look at him. He looks so different, doesn't he? And then you go, but then you think, I mean, he doesn't look much like Dick Cheney, though, does he?
He's unrecognisable.
Dick Cheney.
I didn't know. Yeah. You go, who the hell is that? But oddly, yeah, you're not going, Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
Yeah, really weird.
It's like that film Foxcatcher that came out a few years ago, and you had Steve Carell and what's the fella called? Dancer. Magic Mike. What's he called, that fella? You know what I mean?
Channing Tatum.
And they're wearing like prosthetics.
I've seen Magic Mike 37 times.
Have you?
My favourite film. Well, I've not got all the way through it.
But you don't know, like, it's based on real people, but they're not, like, famous people, right?
What, Magic Mike?
No. Is it?
What?
Foxcatcher.
Oh, Foxcatcher. Famous people. It's a famous case, isn't it?
It
was made famous by the film. I've not seen the film.
It seems weird that they wear prosthetics, but it's like you wouldn't know what those people look like anyway,
yeah, but
right?
They're wearing prosthetics so that you're not thinking, oh, look, it's Channing Tatum. You're thinking, it's Channing Tatum in prosthetics.
With like a film star in, right? With recognisable people.
I think that if you, let's just say you're Channing Tatum and you've given yourself kind of like a broken nose. I think that if I was an actor with a broken nose, I'd find that offensive that it had taken work away from me. I think that you should only do what you are. Which is why I feel very guilty about acting in the sitcom Uncle, because
you're not an uncle.
I'm not one. I'll tell you what I am a big fan of this week. I watched the trailer for Aladdin.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Weird, wasn't it? Because, like, I don't know what people's... I mean, I've got no real attachment to Aladdin.
No, it's fucking awful. It's one of the worst things that...
I don't know what you're talking about. I just think, like, sure.
I read an article yesterday, right, about... I would say a still image of Will Smith as the genie.
Yeah.
Yeah? Fine. Right? You go, yeah, that's pretty much what I was expecting.
Yeah.
In action, in motion, it's a bit of an odd one.
Because, like, people seem to be like, oh, I can't believe he doesn't look like he does in the cartoon. You go, I mean, he does.
Have people actually said that?
Yeah.
I think I read an article about people's wages in the Marvel films, and I think it was something like, for Iron Man 1, Robert Downey Jr. got $500,000.
Yeah.
For Captain America 1, Chris Evans got $750,000, because right. He was slightly, he'd already done some superhero stuff, mm-hmm. And he was slightly more well-recognised. For Thor 1, Chris Hemsworth got paid $150,000.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, that's crazy.
That's like what you get paid here for show, isn't it?
But that's crazy.
Mm.
I've never been paid that much for one job. But I haven't
still.
I haven't been paid far off that for one job.
Right.
For something on Dave.
Yeah.
And you go, that's crazy.
That is crazy.
That's crazy. You're Thor. I do find that crazy. And then Scarlett Johansson got paid. Is it Johansson or Johansson? I mean, when you replied there, you cut off the beginning of the word. No, you've done it again. Just press the button and then count to three and then it's Johansson.
Do you know what? When I just realised, because when Natalie does that, I can only go by mouth. I can't
You can't hear her?
No.
Oh.
Is it only going through to Nick's headphones?
Oh, that's a bit unfair. So Scott Johansson... It's Johansson. That's what I say whenever I see my favourite band.
Alice Cooper.
Alice Cooper. Johansson.
It's weird when you did it.
It's weird. I'm always mispronouncing the word handsome. So that's what I say every time I see Brad Pitt.
Yeah,
when he's not acting like an ugly man. it's crazy that that's what he's doing. Scarlett Johansson got paid $2 million, and Brie Larson's just got paid $5 million for the first Captain Marvel film. And then for I think the second Avengers film, Robert Downey Jr. got paid $40 million.
Yes.
And then for the first Avengers film, he got something like $40 million. And for the second Avengers film, Age of Ultron, he got paid $80 million for Age of Ultron. And that's Disney.
Yes. And they're doing that thing now, aren't they? Because he knows...
But do you know what I mean? It's just like, they've got enough money to pay Robert Downey Jr. $80 million.
Yeah.
Why does Will Smith look so shit in the Aladdin trailer?
Because Robert Downey Jr.'s got the money. I didn't think it looked that. I just thought it looked fine, right?
It looks awful.
I don't get what people's issues are. It just looks all right. What do you imagine it's going to look like? It's going to look like that, isn't it?
But it would have looked better if they'd have literally just painted Will Smith blue.
Right, I suppose.
But they've sort of like, his body... I know he's meant to be like a puff of smoke, but his body just... It feels like it's sort of like juddering, and his face doesn't feel like it's like...
In the right place,
or consistently in the right place.
Maybe they filmed it one of those Instagram filters where they've just swapped the head off something else and they put it on.
Maybe, but I'm just checking that our next guest hasn't worked on this. So in the week I went to see. I was just. I just think it's weird, but I think all those Disney films are weird. I think I really hated Beauty and the Beast. I think Beauty and the Beast is one of my favourite Disney films, next to Sleeping Beauty, which I think, in terms of Art Deco, like the style of the animation in Sleeping Beauty is fantastic.
Yeah, I really agree. I mean, I think that's it. Like, I think we're talking a lot about that kind of aesthetics of Disney movies. Whereas I really like, I know you were criticising me for it, but I really like the aesthetic on stuff like Atlantis and Hercules.
Well,
and
Hercules was Gerald Scarfe. And it's based on that. And what I like about Hercules is that they made a conscious... It's still recognisably Disney, but they've made a decision to do something different. Yeah. And I like that. And I can say that the art direction on Atlantis is fine. The film is fucking boring, though. And I would say that. I got like a Happy Meal toy of Atlantis. And, yeah. Anyway. That's not an anecdote. it was Milo, and he came with a big book, and what you do is you'd scribble over it with a pencil, and...
James Garner, Michael J. Fox.
Atlantis is... but it's such a fucking boring film. But I would say that a lot of Disney films don't really work for me. Mm. I do prefer... I don't understand why they don't just crank out fairy tale films, and they should do them all.
Yeah.
And they sort of do that, and like Tangled was Rapunzel, but hated Tangled.
Yeah,
Frozen was the Swan,
the Snow Queen. Snow Queen, actually.
And all sort of based on that, and I was just like, yeah, it's fine.
I really like Frozen when I saw it, and I wasn't really expecting to.
I saw it on a ferry, so I think it was kind of like it was judged. You know, I mean, it didn't.
I'll tell you what film I saw on a ferry once: The Lawnmower Man. And I think because I was in international waters, there was no 15 certificate. Sorry, it was about 10.
Yeah, abandoned ship.
Oh, yeah. Pierce Brosnan, of course.
Of course. And
can we get Pierce Brosnan on?
Can we get Pierce Brosnan on?
Thank you.
Good. And Jeff Fahey.
Jeff Fahey.
Who was replaced by? In the sequel?
I don't know.
Is it Matt Frewer?
Oh, is it? That makes sense.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Matt Frewer.
Really quite good at this. Yeah, so but the Beauty and the Beast film, I just thought was like, well, what's the point? It was the same with The Greatest Showman, when I watched The Greatest Showman. It's just like, what's the point in having them all on if you're just going to auto-tune the fuck out of every single person that's there? And Hugh Jackman can sing.
Yeah,
but
he's from musical.
Auto-tuned the fuck out of on The Greatest Showman. And you're just like, it sounds horrible. It sounds horrible. Just get one good take of him singing it and then composite his best takes in a straight line, and then make.
There's already a musical about Barnum, isn't there?
What's it called?
Barnum. There's one, and it was.
Which one's the best?
Well, I haven't seen. I've seen bits of
which
Barnum.
Which one's the best? Is it The Greatest Showman or is it Barnum?
Barnum.
Yeah, it's Barnum Barnum. I'm always trying to set you up for something, mate.
I know, but I got your Ready Break one earlier, but that was off air.
Oh, that was off air, that one was. No, let's not bother.
no, let's not.
From Uncle Andy, love this 2-hour laugh fest from Mick Helm.
Mick Helm?
And Nathaniel Metcalf.
I mean, mine's right.
Fan Club on Spotify is the best thing Mick has done since Uncle. Keep it light. Is that meant to be annoying?
How many stars did that one get?
Did my dad write that? Because that's how he used to sign my birthday cards. He's a lazy writer. And he just said Mick. And you go, who's Mickey? Who's Mickey?
It's a nice one. Mick Helm.
Mick Helm.
There he is. Good old Mickey.
It's 5 stars. I don't give a shit. He can fucking stick his 5 stars down his...
Or she.
Down his dick. And they're spiky. Stars, famously. But anyway, the Beauty and the Beast thing, you just like go, everything that they've added has taken away from the
live action Beauty and the Beast.
It's ridiculous. The whole thing about Gaston being being a good looking bully that nobody in town respects. Everyone's sort of like taking the piss out of Gaston behind his back in the live action one. You go, doesn't that completely undermine the point of your message? Which is that Belle has to leave town because you're all a bunch of bastards, and then she finds love with a beast who is actually is pure of heart.
But he's ugly though, isn't he?
But if no one in the village actually respects Gaston, then why has Belle got a problem? She's part of the establishment as opposed to part of the minority.
So no, that does make sense.
I just think it's and that's like just one change that they made, which fundamentally just unravels the rest of the film. And you go, well, what's the point in this? It was better. It was much better than the animated film. Anyway, I don't really like these. I like the Jungle Book, and
the live action one.
Yeah,
I did, and I didn't expect to.
But what's the point in doing a live action Lion King?
I think
it's not Lion King. It's still animated.
Yeah, it's still going to be the same, really. It's just going to be computer generated rather than.
Live action Lion King. What's live? What's live? Have you gone to the Sahara and you filmed the plains of Africa? And what's live about it? Mm. The savannah. Is that America? I don't know my deserts. But tell you what, I do know. 1984, Ghostbusters. So
go on. This is a movie. What is it?
No. I don't want to do one of them. We've got very little time. So, Happy Death Day to You this week was one of the screenings. I really love those films. It's really weird. I watched the first one on. It was like on Sky or something, and I watched the first one, and I literally. There was nothing else on, and I couldn't think of anything. You know, do you know what I mean? It was just like, oh God, we've been scrolling through Netflix for 2 hours, and now it's just like, well, let's just watch this. Neither of us have seen this, and in actual fact, it's really like it's a lot of fun. I wouldn't say it's like, I would say that it's not a kids' film and it's not a grown-up film, but it's kind of like that teenage. It's really great for like, and the tone of it is really great. It's sort of like funny, and it's kind of like got some thrills in it, and it's a bit scary, but it's not really.
So it's not even sort of Final Destination-y or that, or similar to that.
Not really. But basically, Happy Death Day is basically a slasher version of Groundhog Day.
Okay.
And it's about a college girl that keeps getting murdered, and she wakes up every day and she's got to solve the case of who keeps murdering her. And then the second one, which starts off like, they're going to do the exact same thing only with a different character, and then it just goes off in a different direction, and basically it's a science fiction one.
Okay.
So basically they've gone, there is sort of like some a few kind of like jump, no, I wouldn't even say the jump scares, but there are some bits where they're kind of like, they're quite tense where she's being chased. So it's still sort of part slasher, but mainly it's a science fiction film, and mainly it's a comedy. I just really enjoyed it. I think the tone that they've got in them is just really kind of, you know, you always feel fairly safe. Do you know what I mean? You don't feel like they're going to turn into Hostel or The Human Centipede. They're just kind of like these quite light, fluffy films that are really entertaining for like the hour and a half that you're watching them, and then you can kind of go out and do something. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. Yeah. I wasn't expecting to. But what I did, I also saw Lego 2 in the week. And
OnePlus.
Oh, God. It's just the noisiest film I've ever seen. As soon as it starts, it just bombards you with noise and jokes, and about 50% of the jokes don't work, and it's just sort of like, it's just this constant bombardment of noise, and I think it costs more to make, but it looks cheaper, and it feels like a much smaller film than the first one, and I was just like, I don't know. It's
funny,
weird though,
because I've only ever seen them on the small screen. I've not seen any of them at cinema. And I do wonder, watching them, if they suffer. Because I find them both. I've seen the Batman one and the first Lego movie.
I found them fine.
But I feel like I'm meant to get more out of this.
I don't know
but
what Ninjago like, is, so I didn't watch that.
No, I haven't seen that.
And I felt like that was maybe a more straight Lego one. What I didn't understand about the Lego Batman one is that they got Ralph Fiennes playing Alfred.
Yes.
And at one point, Batman fights Voldemort out of Harry Potter.
Right, yeah.
Why didn't they get Ralph Fiennes to do that? Surely there was a joke there.
Yeah.
Where Alfred and Voldemort meet each other.
They've got the same voice or
and
something.
And it's the same voice. But they didn't do it. And I don't think Voldemort even speaks. And you just like go, oh, that's a shit. I was hoping that something like that would have.
It's almost like on small screen, they don't really work because it's. I think they can't really do close-ups, and it all just feels like. Often you're watching it, and there's too much on screen. It's like you're trying to pick out what's going on. It's because they're such small things. I think they're difficult.
It would be like watching Ready Player One on an airplane.
Yes, yeah.
There's too much stuff going on. Maybe, but like people really love it, but I did see it in a cinema that had a lot of kids in, and nobody laughed.
Right, oh, that's interesting.
The whole film. So I don't know. I was sort of disappointed. But what I did find really odd was that it was directed by the guy that directed Juice Bigelow, Male Gigolo. So I only watched it the other week, and then at the end, his name came up on the credits. So I thought, hang on a minute, that's the same guy. And I had to look it up, and I was like, oh, it's mental. But he's got sort of like a background in animation as well. But yeah, it was sort of, I wouldn't say I was disappointed, because I didn't really love the first one or the Batman one, but it was a bit like, oh, I was bored. Do you know what? I was bored all the way through it. But then at the end of it, it's not for me, and I just felt old.
Sure.
I think if you're a parent, it's great.
Because it's a joke, isn't it?
Because it's a cut above, I would say, the majority of animated films for kids. Mm-hmm. And then if you're a kid, you're going to love it. Mm. So it's basically everyone wins in that scenario. But if you're a 38-year-old man who's feeling pretty lonely that day and has just gone to the cinema to hide from the weather, then it might not be everything
you
didn't
even have an umbrella. You return to the cinema, don't you, every week, hoping to find that same umbrella.
Yeah.
Even like films.
And the other question I wanted to know was, is there a way of working out the exact date a film was aired on terrestrial TV from the 90s.
I reckon if you've got some... I reckon there's a way to do it. If the BBC have that genome thing, don't
they? Yes, but I'm not convinced it was on BBC.
Okay.
So the film was Runaway Train, starring John Voight, Rod Steiger and Rebecca de Mornay. Not Rod Steiger. Eric Roberts.
Eric Roberts, yeah.
So it's John Voight, Eric Roberts, Rebecca de Mornay.
Written, I think, by Akira Kurosawa.
It's based on an idea by Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah.
And I don't really remember much about the film, but I do remember that it was on TV on a very special day. And if I could work out the date it was on TV, then I could work out...
what that special day was.
I could work out the exact day of that special day. And on the BBC, the earliest it goes is like 2002, I think, or maybe 1999, but that's a bit too late. It was definitely 93, 94. I was in year 9 at school, so I would have been... I would have been... What's year 9? So
you'd be about 14?
Year 7 is 11.
Yeah,
12. 11. I'd have been 13 or 14.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it'd be nice so that I could celebrate that day every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet there is a way.
Yeah.
Write in. Send an email.
But if anyone can work out, I think, so it was Runaway Train. It was possible. So the BBC archives go back to 2002, which makes me think that maybe they bought the rights to Runaway Train.
Train strikes me as more of a BBC film in a kind of, when they have their late movies on. Like a sort of an 11 o'clock.
I think it was, I don't know, but it wasn't. O'clock. I don't think it was 11 o'clock. I think it was earlier than that. I think it was maybe, and so someone has suggested that maybe it was the 9 o'clock. And then,
ITV.
On
ITV.
And then news at 10.
BBC One, Scotland.
No, I was in England at the time. So if anyone can help, I'm really trying to work out what the date was way back then.
There must be.
Runaway Train or something.
I bet there is. I mean, someone will know.
Possibly. Maybe people remember it. So, you know, maybe people remember it. Rachel tweeted me and said, I remember it being on after Dame Edna once. So
maybe
I think collectively, if we all put our brains together.
I think let me do some investigating. I know people that the kind of people I think would know that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's within a window, and they wouldn't have shown it every week. Do you know what I mean?
Of course, yeah.
So it would have been like
once a year.
Once in a 2 year period, I would say, and I could probably work it out from there.
And terrestrial TV.
Maybe 93 is a bit early. Maybe it would be 94, 95.
Okay.
Eager to know.
Runaway Train.
Eager to know that date in 1994, 1995, when Runaway Train was on. I think it was ITV.
Okay.
Could it be BBC?
Not saying it wasn't. Unlikely to be Channel 4 of that era.
It wouldn't be Channel 4. I think it was a bit. It wasn't necessarily a mainstream hit, but it's in the realm, and
it's in the action realm.
Maybe it's because it's got a train on it, but it's in the sort of same realm that Narrow Margin was on, where it's not a big hit, but it's an ITV or the Presidio.
Yes,
let's watch the bloody Presidio.
Yeah, Well, Channel 4 at the time would have been... it was all sponsored by Stella Artois, reassuringly expensive, and having... It was probably those kind of films, or films made by Channel 4 themselves.
Art house films.
Or a bit more art house, isn't it?
A bit more art house films.
Channel 4. Not these days. Anything goes, didn't it, on Channel 4? Dicks out. People with dicks out, didn't they, on Channel 4?
God, I watched that. What's that show called?
Naked Attraction.
Naked Attraction. Oh, my God.
It's like the end of civilization, isn't it?
I mean, I just couldn't believe that that was a show. I watched it for the first time the other week. Couldn't believe it was a show.
I can't believe it's a show that's, like, on more than once ever. Do you know what I mean? It's like that one with Keith Chegwin, Naked Jungle.
We're trying it. We're trying this out.
Trying it out. And then
trying out a new format.
Oh, no. And they go, we'll never do it again. Don't worry about it. We're
trying out a new format. She's trying out a new foreskin. Stuff like that, you know. We're just, that's the way, Joe likes it. So, so what are we doing? Right, we'll play a song. We've got to keep it on. We didn't do the reviews, did we?
No.
We've got time for one quick review. Where are they? That's what I want to know. Tell your friends, subscribe. What's the first rule of fan club?
Tell your friends about fan club.
What's the second rule about fan club?
Please, for the love of God.
Tell your friends. We've had some fan art as well this week, but... It's on my Twitter feed, but we haven't got time for any of this this week. I enjoy this lot.
Quite enjoyable listen.
Quite an enjoyable listen. Cubicle one. You got the first two letters of that right. See you.
Yeah.
Cunt.
Yeah.
So two stars. Two out of five stars. I enjoy this light-hearted conversation between two genuine friends. They mostly come across as entertaining guys.
What?
Well, that shows just how good we are at radio, isn't it?
Yes.
Between two genuine friends. It comes across like that, doesn't it, guys? They mostly come across as entertaining guys. Mostly.
Mostly.
Nathaniel Metcalf and Nicholas Helm. You've spelt my name wrong there for a start.
How you write Nicholas Cage, isn't it?
That's how you write Nicholas Cage. But I think you'll find that I've got an H in my name, and the H stands for hero. And Helm. Nathaniel Metcalf and Nicholas Helm are lovely gentlemen who keep it light and positive. Oh, fuck off. Go fuck yourself.
My name's got an L in it as
Good
well.
Work. Five stars. Can you get Idris Elba on the show, please? Yeah, of course. He'll be on next week. Right? That's what we want. We want five stars, to the point, and maybe a suggestion here. Can we get Idris Elba on? They've said elbow. I think that's a funny joke. That's a joke from before. Someone was talking about
Idris Elba next week, Pierce Brosnan week after. Stay tuned, guys.
Idris Elba next week, Pierce Brosnan the week after that, because in between then we've got Joey Page.
That's right.
We've managed to book Joey Page. If you don't know who Joey Page is, he's another FUBAR host.
Back to Buck Brosnan.
And then we go back to Brosnan. Is he hosting a show on FUBAR? No.
I'm
a fan. Five stars. Vixter Wu. Love the rants and the rambles. In-depth film knowledge. Helm at his natural best.
Not even mentioned.
As it should be, really. You can stay, Vixter Wu.
I don't know about Vixter Wu.
Absolutely. How do you absolutely name it? And then very funny podcast. Five stars. Thank you, Ian Morley. Indeed your real name. I listen to this podcast while working. While not working, while walking the dogs, while not walking the dogs.
He sounds obsessed.
Nick and Nathaniel, basically, as long as you don't listen to the show whilst operating heavy machinery. Nick and Nathaniel basically wing it for the duration of the recording. And I think that's brilliant. The end result being a really funny podcast that you can nip in and out of listening to, as opposed to a deep, immersive, long podcast.
He's saying he listens to it all the time,
verging on the territory of nagging. While working or walking the dogs or not. You're a very funny guy, Ian. I can see why you've got so much fucking time on your hands to write a fucking 3-paragraph review on iTunes. I had to question why I was still listening. I had to question why I was still listening though last week when I realised I was just listening to Three Blokes deciding what to order for McDonald's. Order it, wait for the delivery, and then eat it. Somehow these guys made this very entertaining.
That was
actually my first listen to this podcast, and I am now hooked. Well, maybe we've got time for a delivery later on today. We'll see. Okay, right. I'm going to play a song, and then we're going to bring our first guest on, and. I will see you at the movies. I should have got the thing lined up before I'd pressed the fucking button. What's the what track is it? This one.
It's fine. No one's noticed yet.
This is
only listening and out, dipping and out anyway.
This is in order to help people with the Brexit negotiations.
Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back in the studio and that was For Britain Only by Alice Cooper. And that's my favourite thing. That's what I like to listen to. So we're all very happy about that. So we're joined in the studio now by Van Ling.
Hello.
You are a film director.
I am indeed.
You've just finished directing a film called Cliffs of Freedom.
Yes, my first time out.
First feature film.
Is that your first feature?
First feature after 30 years in the business.
Yeah, wow. Right. So you started off as a special effects supervisor.
Visual effects. I started out actually as the creative / research / technical assistant to James Cameron. That was literally my credit.
What does that mean? What does that break down to?
That meant I was essentially his extra RAM, kind of handling all sorts of different aspects. I was the research assistant on The Abyss,
yeah,
which meant looking up how fluid breathing works and how naval salvage would work and underwater oil drilling. And
so were you really aliens. Working with practical effects?
Actually, a little bit of both. I have probably the weirdest story of how I got into the business. And it happened in 1986. I was a huge fan of Aliens.
Yeah.
Shot here in lovely UK. A friend of mine on opening night made me a bet, because I do like practical effects and things like that. He challenged me to build a power loader. The big yellow walking forklift in the film, and he said, "I'm having a party in my dorm on Halloween. you know, I dare you to build a little model or something like this. And I'm like, oh, okay. And Halloween rolls around. And I walk in with a 7.5-foot costume with motorized arms and a rotating light. And I built this whole thing out of foam core and styrofoam and wood and you know, paper and string and all sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I built it. It was kind of like a backpack with some stilts and things. And that same day when I was building this thing over the course of the previous weeks, some of the friends who were helping me were like, you really should show this to Jim Cameron. And I'm like, yeah, right. At this time, he had only done Terminator and Aliens.
Of course,
yeah.
And he's at 20th Century Fox.
And you Piranha know, 2. He'd done Piranha 2.
And Piranha 2.
Yeah.
And Piranha 2. But he had, you know, he was completely out of reach, of course. And so, naturally, I ended up calling over to where their offices were because I just graduated from college and USC Film School. And had nothing else to do, so I was building this power loader and stuff just for fun as a Halloween costume. And I had been calling them throughout the period after I graduated saying, hey, you got any jobs? And of course they were like, no, nothing, but call back next month. You know, never talk to anybody, never talk to Jim or anybody, because obviously you just get the secretary. But so
was he that easy to get in contact with them?
No, he wasn't. That's the whole point. And so, but I had called his production office.
But that easy to sort of like get like, you know, when you're like, what is it?
A degree away from
6 degrees from Kevin Bacon, where it's kind of like, that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, what happened was on Halloween, I called them one more time and said, hey, you know, you have any other production assistant positions? No, nothing. We're not in production or anything yet, but, you know, we'll keep you in mind. Well, I got something to show you. What? A power loader. I go, what, one you wear? I said, yeah, it's Halloween, isn't it? Dead silence for a few minutes. And that was like, we'll leave you a pass to the studio. Come on down. We got to see this. So I ended up having to rent a pickup truck and drive this stupid Halloween costume down to 20th Century Fox. They let me on the lot. I go over there, and my friends who are helping me with this, because it's not exactly one-man operation, they're helping me put this thing on in the parking lot. And people came out of the offices and were looking around because this was, you know, only a month or two after the movie came out.
Yeah.
And this was 1986, so it wasn't like nobody did this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Gail Ann Hurd comes out.
No.
Comes to the show. And she says, this is the best walking resume I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I'm like blown away. And then she says, hang on a moment. She goes back inside, comes out and says, you might as well use this to make it complete. And she hands me Sigourney Weaver's jumpsuit and Reeboks.
Oh, no!
And says, just bring them back with the same dirt on them. And
did they fit?
Surprisingly, back then, I actually could fit in it.
But what about the shoes?
And the shoes, too. It was amazing. So these were the high-top version of the Reeboks. As you well know,
they had
a deal with Reebok to make those, what they called Alien Stompers.
Mm.
And the campaign actually never went anywhere because Reebok freaked out, I think, that it was an R-rated movie.
Right.
They ended up
What were they expecting? It was a sequel to an R-rated movie.
Yeah. But, so, you know, but these were the real ones, the high-top versions, because the regular ones were shorter. And so I got to go to my friend's party and win the bet wearing Sigourney Weaver's costume.
That's incredible.
And
she was really tall. Well, she is.
She was tall, and I was much slimmer back then. But so that's kind of how that started. And then a couple weeks later, I get a call. I was living with my parents, working on like a foam core set for one of my friend's student films.
Yeah.
And I get an answering machine message at my parents' house. Hi, this is Jim Cameron. I heard you built a power loader worthy of note. I'd like to come see it. And so he ended up coming down to my parents' house.
No.
Okay, in his Corvette, black Corvette. And he came in and saw me working on my friend's student film, and he gets down on the floor with me and says, hey, you know how to cut this kind of thing over? And because he comes from Roger Corman.
Right.
So he knows and totally understands and respects this whole do-it-yourself kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's how I first met Jim Cameron. And when he found out that I was, you know, an honor student at SC when I was there, and I loved doing research, and I was interested in, obviously, visual effects and all sorts of things, you know, he said, I'm starting another film called The Abyss, and would you like to be my researcher?
Yeah.
And I ended up being his researcher, then I ended up being his is when I say technical assistant, that part of it was, you know, I want to stop using a typewriter and get a computer. What should you recommend? And I was like, get a Mac, because I had just gotten a Macintosh back in 1986. It was only 2 years after the famous Apple 1984 thing.
Right.
And so, you know, I became his computer guy, as well as his researcher, and then
you're the guy that told him to get a Mac.
Yeah, back in the day. Yes, back in the day. And so,
so the world could have taken a slightly different turn if you hadn't been there, maybe.
Maybe. So, does that mean a Terminator is going to be coming after me? I don't know. You tell me. But so, I kind of worked with him for 8 years on that. I was a creative supervisor on Terminator 2.
I mean, the list of films that you've worked on is basically my childhood. It's like the best, Terminator 2, Congo, Twister, The Relic, Dante's Peak, Titanic, Starship Troopers, which is one of my all-time favorite films of all time ever.
Yeah.
So you've worked with Paul Verhoeven.
I've worked with Verhoeven.
What's he like?
He's a manic guy, and he's really smart. He's also really engaged. You know, have you ever seen any of the outtakes of him on Starship Troopers being one of the bugs?
Right.
You know,
I saw him do a talk at the BFI once. Yeah. And he's like really passionate and excitable.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess we were referred to. We had a company. My producing partner Casey Cannon. She was the producer of Cliffs of Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
She and I have been working together for almost 30 years, and we had a company called Band on the Ranch. It was her company. And we did visual effects and screen graphics, meaning a lot of, you know, the computer screens you see in movies.
All right,
we did a lot. That's why you saw Congo and Twister and The Relic and all these kind of shows on there. But I think we got the Starship Troopers gig because Paul Verhoeven was looking for people to replace the people who they had doing screen graphics, because he thought they were boring. They were very military, very dry. They wanted something more kind of brightly colored to go with that universe.
Well, I think the sort of the ones you see in the Alien movies are particularly good, because they have a real consistent sort of sense of design and things, right? They really do.
I'm not sure who did those, but they did a fantastic job on those. You know, there's this wonderful book I found that is about typography in science fiction movies.
Yes.
David Addy, I think, wrote that.
Right, and I think I've seen something of it,
And he talks about all the, you know, how many times people are using Eurostyle font and, you know, these Futura font and all of these. And they show, like, a lot of the graphics and stuff from Alien and all these other different shows. And I've got a couple. There's, like, one montage page of a bunch of uses of Eurostyle. And I've got a couple of my images in there from Star Trek Troopers.
So. How do you mean? Do you mean, like when it's saying, like, Ellen Ripley and it's got, like, the graphic behind you? Right, yeah, and it's got kind of like her date of birth and all of that.
Yeah.
And you're talking about the font that they use for that.
The font that they use for all the signage, you know, you know, the different things. Like in Starship Troopers, we're talking about the fonts for Know Your Foe and you know, I did all the FedNet stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all the fonts that we use for those things, it's all fascinating stuff. And
if you're
really a geek, you will go through Starship Troopers with a fine-tooth comb and try to read every one of those computer screens. There are, like, listings of cadets where all the names are the names of all the characters from John Carpenter's The Thing.
Oh, really?
Or other things like that. I mean, I was kind of...
That is the kind of person I am, I think, because as soon as you go, the typography on screens in science fiction. Yes, please.
I mean,
book on that. Sounds
Oh, yeah. I believe I have read that book.
If you really want to find a fun Easter egg, it's one of the screens I did for a movie called Soldier. There's a graphic screen you see in the movie in the middle where he's between wars, and so he's basically just sitting in a barrack, you know, sitting there, and we do this graphic transition where you see it had all these different things. And as you may know, Soldier was kind of, since it was written by David Peoples, who was one of the writers of Blade Runner, they tried to say that Soldier took place in the universe of Blade Runner, which is why if you look closely, you'll see a spinner in that movie.
I mean,
and what's funny is that the garbage ships
a spinner for people listening at home are the flying cars in Blade Runner.
There you go. Anybody who's listening at home to this podcast who doesn't know that,
seriously. I mean, actually, it's probably fine.
Yeah. So, but there was a graphic screen in this movie where the producers actually told me, oh, you know, because we want to really tie in the Blade Runner connection, we want you to put as some of the campaigns that his character, the soldier character that he plays, has fought in, are like the Battle of Tannhauser Gate, and you know, referring to some of the things that Rutger Hauer talks about as Replicant in his speech at the end of Blade Runner. So I put those in there, and then I said, well, why don't we go further? And you know, I put down some like the weapons proficiencies that his character has, includes an M41A pulse rifle.
Right.
For the aliens fans out there, and an Illudium Q-36 explosive space modulator, for those of you who are Marvin the Martian fans from Bugs Bunny.
That's right.
And then I put a bunch of commendations that his character had supposedly gotten, and they were all named after characters that Kurt Russell played in other movies.
I watched a YouTube video that went through all of that stuff, and you're the guy that did it.
Yeah. So there's some weird. So there's some weird stuff. I love doing that. I was like really big on Easter eggs, and I don't know if your information covers this, but I was also involved in a lot of home entertainment stuff for a lot of these movies. Meaning, I produced the Abyss Special Edition, both the movie and the Laserdisc, and then the DVD. Right. And I did the same for Terminator 2. And I love putting Easter eggs on the discs that I produce. All the Star Wars DVDs for the first six movies.
As in when you have to like go right click on something and then you find like a
menu screen.
Like when, I think, was it the teaser trailer for Terminator when Arnold Schwarzenegger's in a factory? That was one of the, that was a DVD extra on one of the discs.
Yeah, that was a DVD extra. But
I thought it was an Easter egg, wasn't it?
There's a bunch of Easter eggs. I mean, there's an entire version of the film on the DVD that is different. It already has two versions on there. There's the theatrical version and the special edition.
Yeah.
We did an extended special edition in which we actually put the alternate ending with old Sarah Connor, which you may have heard of, on there.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's...
What?
You have to go find
the DVD. Is it a DVD or Blu-ray?
DVD.
So it's a DVD of Terminator 2 where there's three versions of the film on one disc.
It's seamless brass. It's one of the things I did. I tried to help pioneer that process. There's a bunch of us who are producing the discs.
I'm hyperventilating.
There's a lot of stuff out there to find if you just look for it.
I remember in the advent of DVDs, though, one of the most disappointing things you could see was when they would just list special features and it would just say interactive DVD menu. You go, come on, mate.
Or a trailer. Interactive DVD menu, trailer. And so what you're saying is, you can either pick between watching the trailer or watching the film. Okay.
Or watching the menus back and forth.
That's
the thing. I also, one of the things that I did, for better or worse, was I tried to really pioneer the art of doing DVD menus. If you look at the Abyss DVD, the menu system is, you're inside Deep Core and you're actually moving around from area to area, and every area has different things. And there's like, in the middle of Deep Core, I hid behind a door posters of Jim's other movies. That just sounds like a gag. Oh, it's put some posters for Jim's Other Moods. The idea is you could click on them and it would play a trailer for those movies.
Oh, that's cool.
Nice.
So all sorts of things like that. On the Star Wars DVDs, they wanted their normal menus, which is, you know, you have a play menu, a main menu, and then a series of scene menus and so on like that. And I said, hey, there's so many different worlds in the Star Wars universe. What if I randomized them and did three different sets of menus for every movie, so that every time you put in the disc, the menus would all be themed to Tatooine. One time you put it in, the next time you put it in, it's Naboo. Next time you put it in, it's, you know, someplace else.
Hoth.
And we did Hoth, we did Dagobah, we did
Endor,
we did Mustafar, we did Coruscant. Because I ended up doing this for all six of the original movies. Mm. You know,
did you match them to the movie?
They look like they are right out of the movie. That was one of the things I do. And we got materials from ILM. Because I come from a visual effects background, I knew what to do with those elements.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on the Blu-ray, because Blu-ray, they decided it's all about functional menus now. It's not about... You notice the menus on Blu-rays are not generally as interesting or fun as the DVD ones, because that's the limit of the technology.
Right.
Yes. So we kind of... The art of menus is only this very specific period of time. when DVDs first came out to probably about 2006.
Well, that's it, because we're talking about it. We were talking about it together, weren't we, of how like DVD extras are almost like...
I love them.
It's a thing which is almost past. It's an era that had this sort of period of like...
You have to go on
YouTube and find what you want there.
But I really always loved DVD extras. My the first Easter egg I ever found was the one on the X-Men DVD where there's a guy that runs in halfway through a take wearing a Halloween style Spider-Man outfit. Oh yes, but you had to find it,
right? Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I just love DVDs. I love DVDs.
Well, you should check out some of the ones that I've worked on.
I've probably got most of them.
The Abyss, actually. I think now people, I don't think of it as important as it was. But when it came out, that I remember seeing trailers for that and just thinking it felt like such a game changer of it. It just felt like, I don't know how you've done, like, I think the first time you'd see actual computer effects done properly and effectively, it was one of those things. I think The Abyss is a really good example of it, of something where you see it and it's just... It's like your brain suddenly can't quite make out what's happening.
Well, see, the big challenge of The Abyss was it was in one scene, the pseudopod, as we call it. Other people call it the water weenie. Mm. As they call it. And, but it was, here's the challenge of that. I mean, that came straight out of Jim's brain, and it was brilliant. And we came up with thousands of ways to do it, and the only one that really kind of would work was computer graphics.
Mm. What are some of the other ways that you would have tried to have done that?
They talked about replacement animation, which is like stop motion animation where you replace each frame with a different sculpture.
Oh, so, wow. And, okay.
That kind of thing has been done before. Craig Reardon did it in shows like Dreamscape. Did you ever see the Dennis Quaid, Christopher Plummer?
Never saw Dreamscape.
But Dreamscape had Kate Capshaw and... Dennis Quaid as people who could go into people's dreams.
No, I don't know.
Not in a Freddy way, but to try to unlock a murder mystery or whatever. And it was quite interesting. That was back in the 80s. You guys should know that movie.
I feel like I can see the cover.
They did a Snake Man thing where they use replacement animation, which meant they to do the transformation, they sculpted like a couple dozen different man face to snake face thing, and now we do it with computers. But sure. Back then, you had to do it a different way.
That's different from something like the Hammer Draculas, where he sort of dies at the end, and you see this sort of slightly different decomposing.
Yeah, that's one in which they lock the face down and they shoot him, and then they add a little bit of makeup, and then they take some more footage. Yeah.
What's this film?
The Hammer Dracula. Yes.
This is the correct one.
Okay, now I don't think I have seen this.
Notice the Indiana Jones-esque poster there?
Yes, very much so.
Anyway, there's so that was one of the things we discussed on how to do it. Somebody came up with some of the most ridiculous ideas for trying to do the pseudopod. One of them was to take a sock puppet and project. You know, Scotch light is the material that is on road signs that reflects back the light really, really strongly. Mm-hmm. Make a sock puppet out of Scotch light and project water patterns on it.
Wow!
Somebody suggested that. Another person, actually a visual effects person, you know, we were talking to various people. How would you do this kind of thing? They suggested shoot tons of footage of somebody with a fire hose just flailing water around, find frames that match, and string them together. So we got the most ridiculous idea.
It's like the Stone Age, isn't it? People think about it.
Throwing shit at water. Yeah. What sticks? That's incredible.
Yeah, but the ingenuity of just saying, having the gumption to say, yeah, we should just make a sock puppet and do this. I mean,
yeah, but I love that.
That's the brilliance of it. I mean, even though those were kind of silly ideas, they show the sense of ingenuity and problem solving attempts and creativity, and that's one of the reasons that I got drawn into doing visual effects and everything, and ultimately it's led to me directing.
When you go back to sort of like the early days of ILM, when they were trying to do were they doing the sound effects for Star Wars? And they found that if they got a aluminum light bulb. And
there was Ben Burtt was the sound designer for Star Wars, and he had found that if you tap guy wires to like radio towers, they would have this sound, And that's what became the sound for the blasters.
Because they weren't making them on like on synthesizers or stuff like that. It was just like they, it was all made practically.
It was real. It was real because it feels real because it is real. Mm. The way they did the lightsabers was they ran a microphone near like an old Cathay Road Tube TV, cathode ray tube TV, and so it would like give you feedback, and by moving the microphone, it would cause this. Such an iconic sound today.
So over these years, you've always had harbored dreams to direct your own movies.
Well, you learn as you watch, especially at the learning at the side of someone like Jim Cameron. You see how things are done or how you can do it, and how much you have to bring to it. And I went for many years kind of learning from all these different people. Just watching how things are done, because I'm one of those filmmakers who believes that you need to know how everything is done. Mm-hmm. You don't just come in and bark orders and you have to be able to understand how everything fits together and how one piece affects another. And that's one of the great things I learned from him, because I was in charge as a creative supervisor on Terminator 2 to talk to all the different departments and say, okay, Jim wants this, they want this, and you have to figure it out, because each meeting you go into with a department head. And, your director's there and he's saying, okay, I want this done this way and this way. And they all understand exactly what he wants until they talk to the next department. And the next department says, well, he told us this. Well, no, he told us this. And then they're all confused on what to do. And part of my job was to say, actually, he was consistent between them. What he means is this works with this this way. So I learned so much from him and the films that I worked on with him. And all these other filmmakers on how things work, how things don't work, how communication. So I kind of had the opportunity with Cliffs of Freedom to try to take all the things I learned and try to see if I could do it. And the added challenge was, as you can see from my resume, I have a lot of science fiction, visual effects, and other kinds of shows. So of course, doesn't it make perfect sense that my first directorial feature should be a historical period remember.
Yes. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But that's the important thing about filmmaking. It doesn't matter if you're making a visual effects film or a period drama or a thriller, an action film. You have to tell a compelling story with engaging characters. And that's the thing, the most important takeaway you learn from someone like Jim Cameron. He's not just, I'm going to create things you've never seen before, and it's going to be all explosions, and you're going to be wowed visually.
Yeah.
You have to care about the damn characters.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the difference between the first two Terminators and the others.
Yeah.
So tell us about your new film.
Can I just ask a real quick question about what's it like working with Christopher Plummer? He's my Captain Von Trapp is my hero.
He was great. He was amazing. You never know. I was so intimidated, but he puts you at ease. He's really funny. And he is very engaged in the process. Of course there's Captain Von Trapp, but some people remember him as the general in Star Trek VI.
Of course,
some people remember him, of course, from Beginners, for which he won the Oscar.
He was the Duke of Wellington in Waterloo.
Yeah. So he's an amazing guy. He's really nice, really personable. And it was an honor to work with him.
You also got Billy Zane in the film.
Billy Zane.
Did you know him from Titanic? Were you friends for a while?
I had met him before on Titanic, but and one of the reasons I think Billy wanted to do the show is because he's Greek, and the stories about the War of Greek Independence, or takes place during the dawn of the Greek War of Independence. So, he was understandably lamenting the fact that he's playing a villain in this one, but he's really good at it.
And it's been released here, isn't it, in the anniversary of the Greek Independence Day?
Yes, it's going to be released around the time of that. We're building the campaign around that, because this was a huge piece of history for the Greek culture, and most people don't know about it. I certainly didn't when I started this, so it was really a fascinating
It looks gorgeous, the trailer. Yeah. I mean, we've only given a trailer to see, but it looks gorgeous.
Well, hopefully you'll enjoy it. It was really a labor of love for the people who worked on it, and it was kind of made possible by a woman named Marianne Petropoulos. Marianne Petropoulos was somebody who came up with this story idea that she wanted to do, but she wasn't in the movie business. And she found Casey, my producing partner, and Casey brought me in, and that's how this thing kind of came about. She had been trying to make this film for over a decade, and we were the ones who were fortunate enough to be able to figure out how to make it happen. And so hopefully, you know, everything Marianne wanted it to be is on the screen. And I got my first directorial debut, so and Casey her first producerial. So we're really proud of what we were able to achieve on this movie under a challenging subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
And a challenging shoot schedule. So it was and it was completely independent, you know. We shot New Mexico in the United States for Grease.
Right.
So that was really fascinating. But we have some great other actors in the show as well. Tanya Ramon, if you're a fan of Lost, our leading lady was the one who played Rousseau and Benjamin Linus's daughter.
I never saw Lost.
Okay. Well,
I mean, we're aware that it was a culturally significant.
Well, you're allowed to hate Lost. You're not allowed to not have seen it.
Oh, well, I've not seen it, but I went through a period of not watching TV. I mean, now I'm catching up. I'm halfway through season 3 of The Dukes of Hazzard. So,
you'll get there soon. You'll be there soon.
We've got to wrap up.
Fair enough.
But just to finish with one final question. This is from the Ridley's Games Room Movie Buff Quiz. It's multiple choice, but if you can answer it without multiple choice, that is an extra point.
Extra point.
Randy McMurphy is the lead character in which 1970s movie?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Is it A, Clockwork Orange, B, The Exorcist, C, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or D, Jaws? Yes. Nice one. He's also a character in a book as well, so I think that's
correct.
Of the same name. Van, your film comes out again in England?
Later in March.
Later in March.
Look forward. It's going to be like the Greeks in the rebellion against the Ottoman Empire. Hard to find, but very effective when they finally arrive. So... We will be out there.
We could have spoken for ages, I'm sure. We've got a lot more I would have liked to have asked you.
What song am I playing?
Incense and Peppermints.
Oh, that's what I'm playing. Okay.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Clicks of Freedom.
Good luck with the release of the film. And congratulations on getting it done.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mankind, dead kings, many things I can't define. Old Cajun's buzz, writings, butter your mind. Incense and compliments, the color of time. Who cares what games we choose? Little to win, but nothing to lose. Incense and compliments, meaningless mounts. Turn on, tune in, turn your eyes around. Look what you saw. You can do beatniks and politics, nothing is new. A yardstick for lunatics, one point of view. Who cares what games we choose? Little to win, but nothing to lose. Oh,
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back live at 9 minutes past one, and we are joined in the studio by director Jim Hosking.
Hello.
Hello, Jim.
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Yeah.
We just went in the other room for a photo with you, and I thought, do I know you? And yes, I do. I've met you.
Yeah, you're going to tell the story.
This is the reason why we brought you on, actually. Because
Nick's been furious.
Exactly.
The great thing about the show is I managed to actually work out a few of my grudges. And every so often, a real shit of a person will come on, and I'll manage to bring them up on it.
I've been really riding high on having shat down on you from a great height.
Yeah, of course you have. Really quite embittered about this.
This is the only reason we've done this show.
Ten months
we've been building up to this.
It's called Fan Club, to lure people into a full sense of security, and then we pounce on them. I told the story a couple of weeks ago about the McCoy's crisp advert.
Yes.
And you were the director that was directing it.
That's right, yeah. No, I did. I made an advert for McCoy's crisps, and there were three... I suppose meant to be three lads.
You were casting a set of three, though.
A set of three blokes who...
Geezers.
Geezers, who needed directions because they got lost. And I wanted to cast you and a couple of other blokes, one of whom I remember was Welsh with curly hair. Mm-hmm. And we didn't seem to cast any of you three. Mm-hmm. We cast three completely different people.
You didn't cast us three because you were casting us as a three. And it was
either... Maybe that's what it was,
If one of the persons didn't live up to the high standards of McCoy's, then all three of
all
us,
three
all three
drop.
Of us lost the job.
Yeah, I do remember those.
So you lost the job for all the others.
No, that's one of the things that I feel the most delighted about was that I saved all three of us from having to work with Jim Hosking.
Yeah, exactly. Terribly shameful.
You are the director of. Well, I've only seen an Evening with Beverly Loughlin this week, but The Greasy Strangler is I think, the first time I saw it, it went into my maybe top 10 films of all time. And then, so I watched it with my friend Pat, Pat Butcher, Canadian guy, and he came over to England and we were like...
Not Pat Butcher,
brilliant.
She was there too.
Pam St Clement didn't quite enjoy it as much.
I might need a couple of minutes to myself.
She used to live in St Albans, where I grew up, partially.
Would you cast Pam St Clement in a McCoy's advert with two other geezers?
Yeah, she'd get stuck up the tube, though, wouldn't she? I think they all went up the tube. I don't know if they're doing that anymore, though.
I didn't watch the advert.
The guy who went up the tube in the advert, though, I remember the first AD who worked on it, he said to me about a month ago, coincidentally, he said, "Oh, the best bit of direction you ever gave was on that McCoy's thing when you shouted at the guy who went up the tube, 'You've just shat yourself, you fat ginger twat,' like that." And he looked really terrified. I had to get a good reaction out of him.
That's amazing.
Probably
couldn't get away with that in 2019.
No, which is right now.
But Pat Butcher came over from Canada and he stayed with me. And one night we watched The Greasy Strangler and we were both like, blew our minds. And then he went away back to Canada. And then a year later he came back. And when he got on my doorstep, he goes, "Are you watching The Greasy Strangler again?" So it had an impact.
I've only seen both your films in the last sort of couple of months. And I saw an evening.
Too close together.
I saw an evening in Beverly Loughlin. I was like, "Oh, I really like that." And then went back to. And The Greasy Strangler is something that's been on my radar for a while. And lots of people have said, "Oh, you'll enjoy it." And just in that way that I just didn't get around to it.
Yeah.
And then watched that after watching Evening in Beverly Loughlin. And I'm the same. I absolutely obsessed with it.
I really loved An Evening with Beverly Loughlin. My friend came over and she hadn't seen Greasy Strangler, but she was going on about this film. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to watch it because I'm interviewing him on Friday. And so we sat down to watch it. It was on my things to watch for a long time. Yeah. But we watched it. I really loved it. And then we did a double bill and we watched The Greasy Strangler directly afterwards. And she was just like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah.
It's like, it's fucking,
Yeah, it sort of feels like that's the wrong way around in a way.
No, it's I think it's a good way around. I think it's
Really? Yeah. Because I sort of. Oh no, maybe you're right. Yeah, because I kind of went in quite hard, and then I tried to do something sort of quite surprisingly sort of tender and romantic. You know,
it's a way of that was sort my of punk maybe rock like statement. Dipping your toe in the water. But one of the things I liked most about Beverly Loughlin was the performances you get out of everyone. But I think Emil Hirsch is incredible in it.
Yeah.
I've never sort of, not like I don't like him, but I've never sort of like gone, I don't know, he's like that guy that's in Speed Racer and stuff like that. And he was so stylized and crazy in this film. I just thought he was incredible.
Yeah. No, he was... Yeah, I'm not sure what like where the idea sort of came from initially about. I think I'd seen him in Killer Joe. I don't know if you've seen
Killer Joe. Yeah.
So he was in that. But there was just something about his face that sort of felt like it could be quite funny and sort of he could be, you know, very frustrated and sort of angry about his position in life. But he really came to it with just so much enthusiasm and wanting to just push it. I mean, he was pushing it as far as it would go. I had to kind of like edit some of the sort of facial expressions when he really like gave himself a massive underbite and stuff. There were some sort of quite prolonged underbites that had to be cut out. But he's also had quite a tricky time, I think. Like he had an altercation at the Sundance Film Festival, like in, I think it was the year before the Strangler was there, like 2015, where he got in a bit of a ruckus with someone, and then I think he kind of went to jail or something. And but anyway, so
this is Emil Hirsch,
yes,
who's out of Speed Race and Into the Wild,
and not
Judd Hirsch,
who
plays Jeff Goldblum's dad in Independence Day. Do not get them confused.
But anyway, so I think he's kind of got quite a. He's quite happy to take a few risks. And
with Evening Beverly Loughlin, were the actors cast in it, were they aware of the Greasy Strangler? Was that how you kind of got people in to be like, this is, have you seen this?
They had all seen it, yeah. I mean, I think some of them had, no, maybe none of them had actually seen it before they got this script. Maybe that kind of got them to watch it. But, I mean, I had a screening of it in LA at there was like some Sundance Next Fest thing where they screen it at the Ace Hotel downtown. And then afterwards, the guy who was moderating it, who is part of Sundance, he said, oh, there's someone I want you to meet. And so I went down this kind of long corridor, and it was Craig Robinson, who plays Beverly Loughlin. But so he had already got the script.
Who I keep calling Craig Ferguson.
Again, it's a different guy.
Different person.
But so Craig, I think he hadn't said that he was going to do Loughlin yet, but he had just seen the Greasy Strangler. He really did look kind of quite shocked. I think it's quite an assault when you see it on a big screen and really loud.
I can't understand it because I always remember the first time I saw Back to the Future at the cinema. It wasn't long ago. It was like in 2000.
Oh, right.
Maybe it's 2010.
Your birthday,
25th
wasn't it?
Anniversary 2010.
That was the first time you saw it
In the cinema.
Oh,
I'd only
seen
it on VHS. Yeah. You know, and then when you see it at cinema, you realise that there's jokes in it that get a reaction from the audience. Where I was just like...
Oh, like when he plugs in the guitar and whams the chord or whatever. That's the bit I remember.
Yeah, but then there's also a load of jokes in Back to the Future that you don't really realise that are jokes until no one in the cinema laughs at them. Like all of the stuff where Doc is going on about what's wrong with the gravitational pull in the future. Because you've got basically a 16-year-old kid in the 80s that keeps going, using words like heavy, which are basically words that Robert Zemeckis was using when he was a teenager.
That's what I always think of it. Because it's like no one was saying that in the 80s.
No kid in the 80s is saying heavy. And when you're in a cinema full of people and no one's laughing at the jokes that they've written about gravitational pulls and heavy, you go, these are jokes that don't work. And then when you see... But the majority of Back to the Future is filled with people like collectively laughing at stuff, but having only ever watched it on your own and on VHS growing up, you know, you obviously, well, I guess I thought it was a much more serious film than it really was, but I can't imagine. I mean, obviously you made The Greasy Strangler to be watched in cinemas in rooms full of people, but I have not ever experienced that.
So I only have once.
What's that like?
What is the reaction?
Oh, it was really it was really weird. I mean, it was the first ever screening of it as well, so it was at Sundance, it was midnight, it was the first of the midnight films, And I think, you know, you do this kind of red carpet thing or whatever beforehand where they take your photograph. And
there was a red carpet for the Greasy
Well,
Street.
Well, I mean, no, not like that. I mean, there's
everyone
what I
came
mean,
wearing like, a tuxedo.
Was it the Royal Premier?
Yeah, exactly. I was riding on Prince Philip's back. Well, you know what I mean. There was like a thing where you get a photo taken.
Yeah.
But some of the producers started dressing up in costumes from the film unexpectedly just beforehand. And then that was making me really nervous and kind of angry as well. Like, I didn't really want to reveal what anything looked like in the film.
Yeah,
and then
sure.
suddenly one of them's wearing Big Ronnie's suit when he's dancing that's got a diamond cut out so you can see his dick. And so that kind of...
The producers did that?
Yeah, someone did. Yeah.
That's annoying.
And that kind of pissed me off. And then I went in and I was in a state of slight sort of, you know... Just feeling a bit.
Bruce
sort of
Willis turned up to the Sixth Sense as a ghost,
and then, but then I think that, you know, when the film started, no one knew anything about it, and they just thought it was going to be like a
horror,
film. Mm. And it starts out, and there's quite a lot of like, you probably think I'm the Greasy Strangler. Well, I am not. And people go, whoa, yeah, you know, quite sort of pantomime sort of audience reactions. And I think that after about 15 minutes, that just stopped. It
absolutely wiped
dead.
The smile off.
I
wiped a smile off your face.
No, but it was quite amazing because I was sort of, at the beginning, I was thinking like, wow, fuck, God, this is going really well. People are going to love this. This might actually be a complete classic, you know, like I was really riding high on myself. And then suddenly it went dead and I had like 5 minutes where I thought, oh my God, this is a complete disaster. I'm fucked. Like, everybody hates this film. And I felt like all my limbs started really spasming and I was sitting in my chair.
And we also aware
chair,
of what was
like,
coming next.
Yeah, and I was thinking,
there's
loads of weirdness now, like long conversations between people that are just going to freak everybody out. And I thought, this is, you know, it's sunk. And I started like shaking and a lot of people walked out and they seemed to all be sitting around me. Like when I went in to introduce the film, everybody to do with the film was sitting in a particular area, like all the actors... You know, cast, whatever. Oh, that's the same thing.
The actors, the cast,
the
people
there.
In
oh,
it.
The cast were there. But anyway, there was no room for me.
There was a room so for the actors.
Yeah.
And the cast were there as well.
Well, that's loosely used the word.
The cast
actors.
And the actors couldn't stand each other.
Actually, one of the actors had to go and vomit because he found watching himself on screen so disturbing. The sun.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, but, my God. Because he's in Beverly LaFlynn as well.
He is. He's lost half his body weight after watching himself on screen
really?
In The Greasy
Strangler.
How was
that?
Yeah, that's what it was.
But they were all actors, right? Sorry, I'm cutting off the
story. Some were all people that were in the film.
Yeah, I mean, they would definitely call themselves actors. Some of them are more like actors than others, yeah. But so anyway, like after about 20 minutes, I just suddenly felt this real sense of liberation of realising, oh, actually, what I wanted to do with this film, I hadn't really realised till it was playing, was I wanted people to just think, what the fuck is going on? Like, I just wanted to... It's like having three people in a party sort of cornering you and just like jabbering at you over and over and you just can't fucking get a word in and no one else will speak to them. And I thought, well, actually, that's what I wanted. So I started to enjoy it and I think I might have laughed more than anyone else in the cinema. You know?
I think it's really funny. It's a really funny film, but I wouldn't really call it a comedy. Or would I call it
a
comedy?
I think it's a comedy.
But then it's also... I mean, me and Nat were talking about this, and I think like it's a horror film, but none of the horror
is scary
or horrific. But the whole film is fucking disgusting. Like,
is
everything
it?
About the film is disgusting. Yeah,
really?
Like me and my friend Rebecca were watching
really?
It on Monday,
I'm
retching all the way through it. Like, it's like all the amount of grease that is in it.
Yeah, people seem to find that disgusting.
The nudity is disgusting.
I don't find the nudity at all.
The penises
disgusting.
Are fucking repulsive, right? But both ends of the spectrum, right? but what's the other thing that I fucking... the dialogue is disgusting, right?
That's the one thing that's disgusting.
The bit when he's in the pancake shop, they're having breakfast together or something, and he's talking about how he's true of heart, and it literally makes my flesh crawl, and I'm just literally... I'm, like, retching at his dialogue, his over-sincere description of himself.
The one bit that I find really hard to deal with, and I think I can't ever... show this to my daughter, is that when after he's had sex with Janet and he, this is Ronnie, and he rolls over and he says he says something like, I think you could be my forever love. He says, you're so much... Oh, no, he says, you're so much more than a hot, wet pussy. You could be my forever love. It's like, just the mixture of, like, ugh, and then real corny kind of romanticism.
But when she's having sex with the son and he's going, like this, like this. I mean, like the every moment of the film makes my flesh crawl.
And there's quite a lot of stuff from that disgusting scene that's no longer in the film where he's like, she's going down on him and he says, my penis is in the mouth of the most beautiful woman in this city. Like, stuff like that, but it's all gone. You know?
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to see that. I mean, but it's really horrible. And so then I think it's really clever in the sense that it is sort of like a horror film. Like, when you watch a horror film or you watch a slasher film and you're meant to be, oh no, someone's been murdered and it's repulsive and all that. But you've kind of put the murders in there and they're played for laughs. So, but what you've managed to do...
Well, they're very inept, aren't they?
Well, it's a bit when... It's kind of like very obviously that you're using prosthetics.
When his face caves
when
in.
When the guy...
really smashed
I'm
him in
the face. I'm trying not to give it all away, but like... when his face gets caved in. It's funny, right? And that's all funny. But what isn't... but the rest of... It's like the reverse of a horror film.
The thing I think
where
of,
everything else in it is absolutely repulsive.
Yeah, that's...
And flesh-crawling.
Do you know there's that bit in Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch film, and you've got the bit in the cafe where the two guys are discussing. One says, oh, I just saw they had a dream last night and I saw the scariest thing, and they go around to the skip. And there's something about that scene which is terrifying, but it's like, it's not a horror film. You're not watching a horror film, but you're being told something's going to be scary, and then this guy, what actually appears is a man who appears to have Rice Krispies on his face, but you go, oh!
But I think there's terrifying. Isn't there sound when he appears as well?
Yes,
there's something that's really, it's really powerful.
So it's that thing where David Lynch sort of makes horror films, but he doesn't.
Oh, he definitely does.
But you wouldn't call him that, would you? You wouldn't say, it's a horror film.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really watch horror films, I suppose, generally, but I think that things are maybe horrifying when they defy categorization.
Yes.
And that's when things are... Or that's when things really stick with you, you know? And I suppose the thing about The Greasy Strangler is it kind of... It has a weird melding of kind of innocent... Like, it's kind of like a cartoon or like a kid's film, but where the subject matter's got really fucked up along the way. And then it's like this kind of sweetness with a real kind of... baseness, you know. Like,
where do you think that style comes from? Where is it in you? What's the?
Oh God! I mean, I think. I think there's a whole load of things. I think being English and growing up watching Carry On films.
I didn't realise you were English when I watched The Greasy Strangler. I didn't realise you were English. Slightly disappointed.
It is a bit disappointing.
Your background has come from... Oh, go on.
Yeah, but he hadn't finished.
Well...
He was talking about being English.
Oh,
and I was just cutting in saying
it
was English.
Sorry, he cuts
me off all the time, Jim.
Well,
it's unbelievable when he does it. I absolutely hate it when he does that with me, but...
I think, like, my... You know, it's like my family, the TV that I grew up watching, you know. It's like that's the stuff that I always found... funny, I suppose. It's just and it's kind of quite schoolboyish kind of humour as well.
But it's slightly, if it is schoolboyish humour,
but it's
slightly
also
reframed.
Like if I'd written it on my own, it wouldn't be nearly the same. It's like two people kind of egging each other on,
sure,
and trying to make each other laugh. And then I realised when it came to making it, because I wrote it with a friend of mine, Toby, and then I realised, oh, actually, Toby hasn't come out to the shoot. He's not here. I'm the only one representing all of this dialogue
You're
and everything. It's like I'm, this sort of massive kind of pervert who's come out and, like, it's all to do with me. And
so do people come out and show you prosthetic dicks?
Yeah,
and
I had conversations. I had a conversation with the guy who made the penises. Well, one thing I heard sort of, someone said to me, Martin said that that he's worked with a lot of people and he's worked with Mel Gibson and you're even more difficult than Mel Gibson when it comes to getting these penises right.
So, did you have to go through a lot of penises?
No, we didn't. That was one of the really frustrating things. He basically did two that looked completely disturbing to me. They were so sort of like wiggly and like distended and like, I don't know, like if you imagine like a cow's real sort of prize winning curly cock, like the most sort of despicable version, and I couldn't deal with it. So I just drew like a mouse's head, like
that's
a cartoon.
What it looks like.
Yes. I drew a mouse's head, and I said, just do two mouse heads where the balls are either side of the cock, and do a really tiny one, and then a large one, and then give them both a really irritated tip. I think I just
And I'm saying even the penises are disgusting, and you're saying no, I don't find that they are.
Well, I don't.
And
really
now
find
you've
them
described
that.
It.
I think if they were real, I'd find them disgusting. But the fact that they're not, I mean, if that played, was really his cock, I'd be. I would. I'd join the club.
It's so long and tapered and angry at the end.
That's it. I think
it's triangular, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think it is the angriness of it.
Angry. Yeah.
It's
fucking disgusting.
I think that shows a degree of sensitivity in the penis.
This is what I wrote on Twitter. I wrote, "Gross and unpleasant." One of my favourite films of recent years. I love it. It's fucking disgusting, sort of a horror, but the horror elements are funny, so instead the film makes you feel sick and uncomfortable for 90 minutes. Incredible.
Did it make you feel uncomfortable then?
Yeah, sick and uncomfortable for 90 minutes. But that's what I love about it.
Yeah.
Because I'm enjoying that. I'm enjoying sitting on my living room floor, writhing around on the carpet going, oh no! Oh no! I've seen it 7 times. I love it.
But that's it. Yeah. It does obviously have this...
I mean,
it inspires something in people, doesn't it? Because it was just like, it sort of...
I tell you what, one thing it inspired was it got reviewed 3 times in The Guardian. Like once at Sundance, then twice when it came out in the... Had a very brief cinema thing. And it went from 4 stars to 3 stars. And then I think... My mate Joe, who plays like Oinker in the film, who has a pig's nose,
that's absolutely disgusting.
He texted me and said, "You've got to look at the review in The Guardian today." And I was like, "Oh, it's going to be really good." And I opened it, and it was 0. And I'd never ever seen 0 stars. I didn't think they even did that, you know.
Zero.
And it was like, I thought, God, there's like a printing error. They've forgotten to give it 1.
It got 0 stars. What did the review say?
It went 4-3. Oh, it was a very, very short review that just basically, it was a bit like shit sandwich in Spinal Tap for shark sandwich. It was just like, there is nothing of like any merit in this film whatsoever. It was just basically just like, this is just awful.
Such a shame. That's such a shame that they're living their life like that.
Yeah, no, I think
I feel
so
sorry
too,
for them. Don't worry, we get reviews like that all the time on iTunes.
I don't
fan
worry
club.
Don't I worry. Should though. I strangely don't care.
No, I don't think you should.
But I think actually,
0 stars. Fuck off.
Yeah. But also, if you read some of the things that get 4, and you go,
I know why.
It's like, it's almost like it's when you're able to read.
It's trying to make the film in a correct way.
Fucking hell! Have you seen Uncle Boon Me in his past lives?
Oh, I love that. Though.
Oh my God!
Oh really?
Fucking hell! 5 stars on fucking Guardian, and I've fucking watched it, and I watched it all the way through. But fucking hell!
Yeah.
Like, you love that film?
I do actually.
Oh
God!
Maybe I'll reassess The Greasy Strangler. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But Uncle Boon Me and his his past lives.
Something like Who Fears His Past Lives, I think.
What do you like? What do you like?
Well, I love David Lynch, for example, but I think I like anyone who just feels like they're doing their own thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of as simple as that.
And I suppose there's something like David Lynch does those sort of, when he does actual funny things in his films.
Oh, they're the funny, literally the funniest, like to me,
his comedy.
That bit in Mulholland Drive where they get the guy the espresso. That is the funniest. I can't think of anything funnier.
Well, that's it.
That's
the kind of...
What happens with the espresso?
Well, there's this really big deal about how they've got to get this this guy this espresso. And he's like sitting this really sort of forbidding... He kind of looks a bit sort of mafia, like a sort of tough guy kind of. He doesn't say anything. He's just sitting there. And there's a really big deal made between all these characters about, look, are you sure it's going to be all right? It's like, no, trust me. Honestly, it's much better than last time. This is going to be really good. And the guy comes over and gives him the espresso, and he's like, you're going to really like it. This is really good, this espresso. And it's just like, and it just builds and builds and builds. And he sort of drinks it, and then it's like this reaction sort of within him, and it starts like dribbling out of his mouth, and it's kind of really hilarious and disturbing.
Yeah, it is.
Someone gets a napkin and like starts wiping his mouth, and then it's just like
it's like
the biggest sin in the world.
It's like you're watching something angry happening.
No, it feels really powerful, but it's just amazing that it's about just getting someone the wrong coffee, you know.
Right.
But
that's meant to be funny.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. I mean, so I think David Lynch's films generally are meant to be funny.
But it's the bit when he kills the guy and someone walks in, and so he's got to kill them, and then someone else sees him dragging the body down the corridor, and so he's got to kill them. That's funny, is it?
I think so.
Okay. Maybe I'll watch it again. I'm watching these films going, that's crazy.
But I think that those sort of bits in David Lynch films, not David Lynch the whole, but you can sort of see things like that in your films.
But David Hopper's so... I mean, Dennis Hopper.
Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet. It's funny.
Velvet,
yeah, I find a lot of that stuff really funny. And I often find things that I think aren't, or people don't seem to think are funny. I always go, no, I'm sure that's meant to be a joke. I'm sure it is.
But you know, like when you're the only person in the cinema laughing at something, it's just like, you just find...
Mannequin on the Move. I was the only person in the cinema for that, though, so...
Were you laughing all the way through?
American on the Move.
Yeah.
Come on, Hollywood. He's hilarious.
Actually, someone tweeted that there was, Beverly Loughlin was released in Finland on something like 16 cinemas, and I was thinking, oh, that's good. Like, people in Finland must really love it, and they want to go and see it. And then some bloke in Finland tweeted a picture of an empty cinema, and he was like, he'd see an evening with Beverly Loughlin about to start. I'm the only person in here. And then, like, a minute later, there was another tweet, and someone else had walked in and said, now the audience is 100% bigger than it was.
that is an incredible achievement. I went to see... What was that Arnold Schwarzenegger film?
The
Last Stand. So it's his big comeback film. Saw it on a Friday night, Leicester Square. Friday it came out. Leicester Square Odeon. The big one.
So it holds out many people.
The 500-seater. And there were four of us in there.
But it's weird that you're one of the four people who wanted to go and see it. You know what I mean?
I love Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Me and Hayley.
It was his big comeback.
Me and Hayley Campbell went to see it.
It was a good film.
Yeah.
It wasn't a perfect film. It was an ensemble. It wasn't like an Arnold Schwarzenegger mega hit, but it was a good film.
Did you have a chat with the other three afterwards and sort of like...
No.
You sort of nod at each other, though, don't you?
We couldn't see each other. We were so far away from each other. We couldn't make out features on each other's faces. But what is weird is that I think I went with Stuart Laws. We sat like three rows from the front, and other people were sat like
miles back
in the back row. And it's just like.
It'd be weirder
anywhere.
If the four of you were all sat next to each other.
We did that once. We sat right in front of someone.
Someone sat next to me in a massive empty screen, like one away. Like it's almost
looking
like
at you.
No, but it's almost like just like further than that, mate.
Yeah.
Like fucking one seat away is not far enough.
Went to see the Avengers. What's the last Avengers film? Not Age of Ultron. War Game, whatever it's called. Infinity Wars. And somebody had to go at me because my drink was in their cup holder. And you go, just use the other one. Just use the fucking other one. People are fucking mental. As soon as you fucking leave the house, that's when the problems start. Stay in, draw the blinds, run yourself a hot bath.
So, Jim, did you remember Nick?
Listen to Fan Club.
Don't leave the house. You remember Nick, or did you? Were you aware of Nick's work then? Was he?
How long ago
was it?
I think it's 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
You're talking about me?
Yeah.
No, maybe
it was
9 years ago.
2009.
Yeah.
It was
2010.
Maybe it's 2010.
Something like that.
I think I was about to go to Edinburgh, and my agent phoned me up to tell me that. I said, "What's happened with this thing?" She goes, "Oh, that's gone away."
Yeah.
Oh. Why? I can't believe it, Nick.
No, I felt quite embarrassed about it. I think I actually sent you a message on Facebook to apologise.
Really? That's mental that we've met each other and we've had a past life.
Yeah.
We've got to play a song and then we'll do the...
Oh, we're playing your song?
Well, I couldn't really think what to play, so I just
chose the
song.
So you just picked something from your own film. Yeah,
yep,
unbelievable.
That's right. Yep.
It's all right. I play songs from Uncle every week. It's good. I don't, not done that once, have I?
No.
It's very restrained of me. So which one would we want? We've got the version original, or we've got a 90s remix?
I think version original.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Even though you've heard it in the edit over and over again?
Absolutely.
Okay, you don't want the 90s
remix. How's it got its headphones on?
Okay. Can I press it? Oh, one of the buttons. So we're back. I'm just eating some blueberries, and we're
still with Jim Hosking. And that film was in that song was in Beverly Loughlin.
Yeah.
Did you like the song anyway?
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, I liked it as a child. Yeah, I did.
Did you sort of have it in mind? Did you know immediately?
No, I asked a friend. No, I was. I was pretty unsure what to play at the end actually. In fact, I think I was. I mean, I had like a lot of thoughts, but they all just seemed completely wrong. It was like trying to find something that felt like it wasn't. Like anything that felt like it was trying to be sort of cool or whatever was just felt completely wrong. But then I didn't want it to be sort of too kitsch and ironic. Mm-hmm. And actually, I like this song, and I sort of feel like it's quite sweet and quite.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's quite earnest. But it also feels like it doesn't really come from any particular place. Like, I think he's German or something. And it feels like, you know, you can almost not tell whether it's a man or a woman or where he's from. And I just like the fact that it was just this thing that just seemed to exist, like, in its own little space.
It's very earnest, isn't it? It doesn't mean... You're enjoying those blueberries now?
Can you hear them?
It's kind of like the tone of the film is, I suppose, also, is like it's a bit ridiculous, but it's also... earnest as well.
Have you got plans for another film? Have you got
I've got a few things bubbling at the moment. Yeah. Yeah.
And is that now, are you still doing adverts? Is that still?
I haven't really done any for a while.
Right.
I mean, I probably need to do something for a bit more money. Yeah.
Right.
But I'm, no, I sort of feel like more and more like, you just want to give your time to stuff that you give a shit about, you know.
And so you're writing currently?
Yeah, I am actually. Yeah. Yeah, I'm always writing stuff. Yeah. I'm just, I mean, I just did a TV show in America. For Adult Swim, have you heard of them?
Oh yeah,
which is being tweeted about at the moment. Like, it's, I think it's really polarized people, and like some people absolutely hate it.
Do you?
What is it?
It's called Tropical Cop Tales. I can send you a link.
Oh yeah, yes, send me a link.
Yeah, it's like a, they're like 12 minutes long or something. There's like 10 episodes. It's like a, It's like, nominally, it's like a cop show, but I think that we just came up with the name Tropical Cocktails because it was like cocktails, and then it was like, oh, we should do that, and it's, you know, it's not like a cop show at all. It's kind of like a load of weird old men in dresses, I think.
But there's no cops in it.
No, there are, but
it's not
they
a
don't
cop
really,
show.
No, but they don't really do much. They don't really say
they're cops,
much.
But it's not a police procedure.
I feel like they feel a little shortchanged because they're in it very infrequently and they don't have much dialogue, and it's all the other people who just seem to be sort of like talking the whole time.
But they're the title part, so they can take that.
They can take that and then, you know, probably feel quite aggrieved that they're not really given the necessary limelight.
Sure. But I think that's you're talking about very petty people.
I'm talking about people who are just grateful to be out of the house.
I'm not
grateful to be
out of the house. I prefer staying in.
Yeah, but
this is just around the corner for me. This is just right, slightly further away from Nat. He lives on the other side of London, but it's just around the corner for me. That's good.
What, the blueberry?
The blueberry, the chat, the weather, just having a nice time. What are you a fan of, Jim? What's your favourite film?
Well, I was asked, what's my favourite film?
Well, I know, I've seen what your answers are, but let's go.
Favourite film? Well, what's coming to mind? I mean, I like Wild at Heart by David Lynch, I guess. I like Nuts in May by Mike Leigh.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
I like... there's so many. I mean, like Taxi Driver, I think, is like a perfect film.
Taxi Driver's a good example of a film that's really funny that people don't seem to think is funny, I think.
Yeah.
I find it so
King of Comedy
funny.
Is brilliant as well.
Yeah.
But that...
I like
isn't so funny, is it?
King of Comedy. I don't think it is as funny as Taxi Driver. I think Taxi
Driver
is a really funny film.
I think King of Comedy is so funny.
I really love King of Comedy.
I love it.
I'm not saying you don't, mate. I'm just saying that I like it. All right? Just because I like something doesn't take it away from you, Nat. Come on, share your presents at Christmas. I really love King of Comedy. I think it's like the way comedy has gone now.
Exactly.
Which is like awkward comedy since The Office. And
yeah, exactly.
But it was done in 1980.
Is it still awkward? I mean, is that still like kind of...
The current?
Yeah. I don't really watch comedy at all, I have to say. So
There is a lot of it. I don't really watch comedy. I watch cookery shows.
Do you? Mm. Oh. Have you got one you could recommend?
Rick Stein's son. What's Rick Stein's got? Jack Stein. He's brilliant.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I watch cookery shows because if I watch comedy, I'm just like going, oh God, it's work. You're watching it and it's competitive and you're just
exactly.
like, so I don't.
Or it's just people doing things in a way that you wouldn't want to do it.
It's annoying.
Yeah.
So I don't tend to watch it. I watch cookery shows and it's very
relaxing. I like Breakfast Club or I like Room with a View. I like Some Like It Hot. You know, I like a load of weird art housey kind of films that I'm not going to mention here because I'll just sound like an arsehole.
Name one.
I mean, I like Aki Kaurismäki, the director from Finland.
Yeah, there you
like,
go. I can see that.
He's one of my favourites. I like Fassbinder, the German filmmaker who died when he was about 37.
Aki Kaurismäki is someone who's also very funny, isn't he? That some people take overly seriously. And go,
yeah. But if you look like, if you watch like Fear Eats the Soul,
tell me about
Fassbinder.
Him. I don't know anything about him.
He
and I feel
he
sort
makes
of
kind
like
of sad,
betrayed
like,
by Nathaniel. That is
what,
just
for having seen it.
That you've heard.
They're like
it.
Sort of set like very sad kind of deadpan, I suppose, comedies. Like set in, they're in Finland. He's from Finland, and there's like a particular styling to them. Like, I mean, I suppose a bit like what I've done with my two, but it feels like they kind of exist in their own little world. But he's still going. But I think he might have just made his last film like a year or two ago, which wasn't so great. But the one he made before that was really good, called Le Havre. And I mean, he's made like, he must have made like 20 films or something. So over the last probably 30 years or something.
Do you remember Leningrad Cowboys in the 80s? Do you remember those movies coming out? Okay.
No. I feel like, yeah, if you don't know who he is, this far in, you wouldn't know who he was.
Probably. Yeah,
no,
but
no.
I think like Jim,
no, but the
like
thing
Jim
about the
John
show
Moose
as well isn't to we're all experts on stuff,
right? Well, but I mean, like, say, like, do you know Fassbinder's films at all? German director,
Alien Covenant.
I know of him, but I don't think I've seen
you should like you should watch. You should really watch Fear Eats the Soul by him. I think you'd both completely love it. It's like a, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, like Harold and Maud.
Yes, yeah.
So it's like a love story, like a really peculiar love story between an old German woman and an Algerian man, and they're kind of ostracized by the community for this. But it's just, there's something hysterical about the film, but it's also really, you know, sincere, and it's just brilliant. I don't know, you know? You see, and I think he, like, shot it in, like, 12 days or something while he was waiting to make something else. It's a bit like One Car Why making Chungking Express when he was going to make Fallen Angels, I think.
Right.
He just kind of, he had a hold up in production and he just got on with it and did it. But, you know, there's a Korean director I love called Hong Sang-soo, whose films I think are brilliant. And they're kind of a bit like, there's a French filmmaker, Eric Rohmer, whose films I love. But that's kind of what I grew up watching. Like,
what
my
did
mum,
Eric Rohmer direct?
Well, his most famous film is called Claire's Knee. I mean, they're like the opposite of what I do, but it's kind of like what I, when I grew up, my mum was kind of...
Where did you grow up?
In London.
Whereabouts?
My dad was in Shepherd's Bush and my mum was in Chelsea. And my mum used to take me to the cinema all the time to go and see foreign films. She was quite sort of anti-American and sort of, I mean, not like, you know, like it was her agenda, but she was just sort of, I think she wasn't...
There's a bigger world out there.
Yeah, I think she just sort of felt like anything that was sort of French or whatever, that was just somehow sort of had more value. It was as simple as that. And so that's kind of what I would always go and see. And
which cinemas did she take you to?
Well, it's the one that is now called the Chelsea Cinema. I can't remember what it was called then, but it's on the King's Road. It was pretty much that one. There was like one, like it had one screen and it would show a new film every 2 weeks or whatever. So I just go and see whatever came out then. But you know, it was like in my 20s or something, and watching like Dumb and Dumber when that came out. And I remember just thinking, it was just so, like, I went with my sister and her boyfriend, and I just thought it was so stupid and I really hated it, and
in
I thought I was kind of above it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then just something shifted within me. I don't know. And then I just, you know, started to really enjoy, like, not taking myself so seriously, you know.
Yeah. So you thought Dumb and Dumber was stupid.
And now I...
But now I make
stuff that's more stupid.
Yeah. Sure. Well, but it's different.
Different kind of stupid.
It is different kind of stupid.
Yeah.
I don't know. I never...
I think maybe I understand that kind of just... I mean, actually, what it was going to see There's Something About Mary in the cinema with my mate, who, he's also a filmmaker, and he makes, like, serious films, and we both probably took ourselves quite seriously. We were living together at the time, and we just wanted to go and see a film, and we saw that was on. I think we both went along thinking, like, that's going to be really stupid, we won't enjoy it, and then we just fucking pissed ourselves laughing, and that's kind of like something that breaks you down. And,
yeah.
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 So,
whether it's that film or something else.
Yeah.
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 Have you seen Green Book?
Yeah.
Because that's a fucking massive shift from a director to go from Something About Mary to Green Book.
Yeah, that's quite strange, though, isn't it? I didn't know anything about it when I went to... I went to see it with a director of photography who I've worked with in... I was in LA and saw it in the Academy's theatre, and then there was a Q&A with all of them afterwards, like Viggo Mortensen, whatever. It was like, and I just thought I was going to go, and I didn't know what the hell it was, and it was like, God, it's quite a big thing. But it was just after he'd had some controversy about using the N-word.
Oh.
Who had?
Viggo Mortensen. Do you not know
when
about
did he
that?
Use that?
I think about 2 days earlier. It was there during was during the promotional campaign for this film.
There's loads of controversy about Green Book where...
Yeah, about rewriting the...
Well, about the family being completely angry about the film, it being kind of like Oscar baity, kind of like, oh, the Academy are mainly white, so it makes them feel good to sort of nominate that sort of film. And also, is it Peter Farrelly or Bobby Farrelly? It's Peter Farrelly.
Peter.
Everyone's got an anecdote about... Well, I don't know. Is this I don't know. Is this libelous? I don't think it's libelous. My friend was telling me about this thing that she read where it comes up in every interview that everyone's got an anecdote about Peter Farrelly getting his dick out.
We'll find out. It's libelous.
No, but they're just like going, oh, yeah, he just got his dick out. And, yeah, everyone's... I don't know. But my friend told me this, so maybe I...
This feels like I'm cutting it off, but we've got to do a game.
Oh, fuck. I've got a game to play, I'm afraid.
Okay.
In fact, we don't have to do the game.
Yes, me too. What are you fucking talking about?
All right.
Just because he's directed. Just because he directed The Greasy Strangler, you treat him like everyone else now.
So this is called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before.
And am I being serious or not?
Yeah, but it's based entirely on my own opinion.
My opinion. Oh, right, okay.
So you can only guess. So starting off with Vincent Price. Is Sir Ian McKellen better or worse than Vincent Price?
Worse.
Is Jerry Halliwell better or worse?
Worse.
She is worse.
Then who? Ian McKellen?
It doesn't matter,
Jim. There's a fucking leaderboard here.
Okay, all right.
Is Brad Pitt better or worse than Jerry Halliwell?
Better.
Oh, that's pretty difficult, isn't it?
I think it is. They're both low cards, but yeah, I would say
it's sort of
he's
really
better.
Hard.
Better.
It's kind of like diarrhea and. Look on.
Is Annie Lennox better or worse than Brad Pitt?
Better.
I'm going to say worse.
What?
Really?
Are you fucking kidding?
Yeah, come on.
Are you fucking kidding? No more
stranger.
I love yous. No more I love yous.
No more. Chevy Chase. Is Chevy Chase better or worse than Annie Lennox?
Worse.
Yeah, I'd say worse.
I would say worse, but also when Chevy Chase is good, he's very good.
I'm going to say better. Mel Brooks, better or worse than Chevy Chase?
Better.
Ugh. Is Lin-Manuel Miranda off of Hamilton?
I know nothing about him. Yeah.
Is he better or worse than Mel Brooks?
Worse,
yeah. Is Joanna Lumley better or worse than Lin-Manuel Miranda?
Better.
Reading an auto cue.
Yeah. Is Viola Davis better or worse than Joanna Lumley?
They're both high cards.
They're both... I've only seen her in Widows. She was in Widows, wasn't she? I thought she was very good in that.
She was very good in Widows.
I would say probably Joanna Lumley's been around a lot longer.
Maybe we're getting a bit bored with Joanna Lumley. Mm. She's very nice, though.
I think better. Yeah, probably better.
I mean, I don't know her.
That's it.
Is it? Okay.
That's the game.
Well, I thought that was the most controversial of all of the better or worse, to be fair. What has he scored? Seven. Oh, seven. You're in good company with seven.
Yeah.
You're up there with Hayley Campbell, Brett Goldstein, Charlie Higson, Matthew Holness, Laura Laxey and Smith, Josh Widdicombe and Sean McLaughlin. You're not quite as good as John Niven, Sean Harris with the full 10, Daniel Cook, Daniel Lawrence Taylor, Michael Legg, Solomon Gray with 9, Claudie Blakely, Jordan Brooks, Suze Kempner, Evelyn Mock, Paul F. Taylor, Rebecca Shorts, Mark Smith and Carl Leopold.
I've got a lot
eight.
More competitive.
But you are better than Drunk Women Solving Crime, Colin Hall, Andy Kindler, Merritt Larwood, Lucy Porter, Richard Sandling, Mark Simmons, David Trent with 6, Yasmin Akram, Rob Deering with 5, Jack Berry and Bunny Galore with 4, and unbelievably, Sam Ashurst with 3. Oh dear. So we've come to the end of our time with you. That hour went by very quick, didn't it?
It is, yeah, very good. Very good. Sorry, I just spat. I think I spat over your tea, don't worry. I'd worry about that printout. Yeah.
Okay. You got anything?
I won't say
The people that you're fans of are people that are more awkward than you, people having trouble walking in high heels, and people with a gap between their front teeth. That's fan club.
I think bigger than that.
Thank you very much for joining us. Have you got any last words?
Like Flea in the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Like it?
Any last words? All right, guys.
He's all right.
I'm trying to wrap the fucking show up.
We're trying to talk about Flea.
gonna call?
Ghostbusters!
There's something weird and it don't look good. Who you gonna call?
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.